Good evening, everybody, and thank you, Alison, for that introduction. It's a great honour for me to have been invited to give what is the 54th Shan Memorial Lecture, particularly given the illustrious list of speakers who've preceded me. I'd like to thank the University of Western Australia in particular for the invitation. It's a delight to be back here in Perth. I think I was last here for one of the In the Zone conferences a few years ago. I think looking back at the list of Australia's distinguished economists, Edward Shan stands very tall. His work emphasised the importance of looking back to history to find, to help us understand what the future might hold for us. He was a tireless advocate for market-based policies, including in the foreign exchange market, the labour market, and in the commodity markets. He was a strong and prominent voice against the tariff war that was being built around Australian industry. And his writings emphasised the importance of spending public money wisely and the dangers of excessive and poorly designed regulation. I suspect that if he was amongst us this evening, he would see much that he liked in the Australian economy of 2015. And while we still have quite a lot of work to do in a number of areas, I think we are closer to the world that he advocated than we were in the 1920s when he was doing much of his work. I think most of us would think that this move to a fairly liberalised, market-based economy has served Australia and its people well. I think reading through Shan's work in preparation for this evening's talk, I was struck with his fascination with two other very modern Australian interests, and they are balance sheets and land prices. Now, while I didn't come across him using the exact term balance sheets, Shan's writings display a deep interest in the evolution of the liabilities and assets of both the public and private sectors. He understood the dangers of excess leverage. He understood the importance of making sure that assets generated a return to cover their financing costs. And he understood the differences between current economic activity and the accumulation of wealth. But at least for me, it's Shan's discussion of land prices that really made his writings come to life. He speaks extensively of bubbles in property prices. He speaks of the log rollers pushing projects that increase the value of their own land. And he speaks of the antics of the so-called land jobbers. And when talking of the land boom of the 1880s, he cites with, I think, some disquiet, T.A. Coghlan's observation, and here I quote, "Free conveyances carried people to the sales. Champagne lunches gave them courage to bid. And extraordinary terms of credit reconciled them to their purchases." It might sound familiar. But today, most people mostly find their own way to the property sales, and there are probably rules against serving champagne during the bidding process. I hope it's only consumed at the end. But our fascination with land, its value, and its financing has endured over the years. In a way, it's become part of our national culture. And it's this interest of Shan's in balance sheets and land that really serves as my motivation for this evening's talk. Most of the time, economic commentary focuses on changes in income and spending, things like GDP, consumption, exports, imports, retail trade. There's a long list of regular data. Most of the time, though, much less attention is paid to developments in the national balance sheet. And when attention does turn to the balance sheet, the focus is often, perhaps too often, on the liability side and not on the asset side. And so this evening I'd like to take this opportunity to talk a little about Australia's national balance sheet, and particularly the asset side of that balance sheet. My remarks are really in three parts. In the first, I will look at what we know about our national balance sheet and how it's changed over time, particularly how there's been a change in the relative importance of land and physical capital. In the second part, I'll discuss the increased value of the land and how we might interpret the increase in the value of land. And then finally, I'll discuss how some of these issues have a bearing on monetary policy. So first, to the national balance sheet and what we know about Australia's net wealth. Now, constructing such a balance sheet is a very challenging task, and there are measurement challenges almost everywhere one looks. While we can measure the value of physical assets with some precision, estimating the value of other assets is incredibly difficult. For example, one of Australia's most important national assets is our institutional arrangements, things like the rule of law, the stable political system, our strong, credible institutions. But putting a monetary value on those type of assets is now impossible. There are also challenges in measuring the value of other important national assets, our cultural heritage, our human capital, our rich and varied natural environment. And around the world, there are various efforts that are going on trying to measure these type of assets. But unfortunately, most of this work remains largely experimental. And this means that inevitably, the construction of a national balance sheet is only partial. It only includes the things that we can measure with some confidence. Notwithstanding the difficulties here, the ABS has, since the late 1980s, been producing an annual balance sheet for Australia, including annual estimates of Australia's net wealth. That is the difference between our assets and our liabilities. And tonight I want to talk a little about what the ABS tells us about our national balance sheet. Before I do that, there are two technical issues that I think are worth briefly pointing out. The first is while the balance sheet includes a wide range of assets, it does not include the assets that I was just talking about. The assets that are included are man-made assets, things like buildings, infrastructure, plant and equipment, as well as land, weapon systems, livestock and timber, inventories and the known mineral resources. A number of intangible assets are also included, computer software, intellectual property and research and development assets. So it's a broad list of both public and private assets, but it's not a universal list. The second technical point is the balance sheet does not include financing transactions that are internal to Australia. It doesn't record when one Australian provides finance to another. And this reflects the fact that internal financial transactions do not affect the risk profile, our national wealth in and of themselves. It's what's done with this internal finance that matters. In contrast to these domestic financing transactions, when we draw on funding from the rest of the world or we buy assets abroad, our net asset position is changed, and so these external financial transactions with the rest of the world are included in the national balance sheet. So much for the technicalities. What do the data tell us here? And there are four broad observations that I want to, facts that I want to draw your attention to. The first is that according to the ABS's latest estimates, the total value of Australia's assets at the end of June 2014, which is the latest data that we have available, the total value of those assets was around $12.5 trillion Australian dollars. So that amounts to a bit over $500,000 for each person living in Australia today. And if you make an adjustment for our net foreign liabilities, the net asset position or net wealth was around $10 trillion, which is the equivalent of six times Australia's current annual GDP. The second observation is that over recent decades, net wealth has increased at a faster rate than its GDP, and you can see this in my first chart. Between 1989 and 2014, the nominal value of net wealth has increased at an average pace of a bit over 7%. That compares with an average increase in nominal GDP of around 6%. As you can see, while net wealth grew more slowly than GDP in the first half of the 1990s, for most of the time since, wealth has grown more quickly than income. The third observation relates to the composition of our national assets, and that's summarised in this next chart. As you can see, land is the asset class with the highest value. As of June last year, it accounted for 34% of the value of our national assets. That's followed by non-dwelling construction, that's offices, factories, infrastructure. That accounted for around 18% of the total assets, and then foreign financial assets and the value of our dwellings each account for about 15 or a little under 15%. And you can see there on the left, intellectual property assets account for just 2% of the national balance sheet. The final and perhaps most interesting set of observations relate to how the structure of this balance sheet has changed over time. One very clear trend has been a substantial increase in the value of our foreign financial assets and liabilities, which, as you can see here, have both increased faster than our net wealth. In effect, as we've become more globally integrated as a nation, there's been a grossing up of our balance sheet with the rest of the world. Australians now hold many more foreign or assets overseas than they once did, and conversely, overseas residents now hold many more Australian assets than they once did. But in net terms, Australia still has a net liability position with the rest of the world, having drawn on foreign savings for over 200 years. Interestingly, though, while our net liability position relative to our national income has been steady in recent decades, as you can see from this next chart, relative to the value of our national assets, the net liability position with the rest of the world has declined and is currently at its lowest level in around 25 years. In terms of non-financial assets, there have also been quite significant changes over time, and you can see that here. I think the most striking change has really been in the relative importance of land. Indeed, almost three-quarters of the increase in the ratio of net wealth to GDP since the late 1980s is explained by higher land prices. And given the significance of this change, I want to explore it a bit later on in this talk. But before I do, it's worth talking about some of the other changes in the balance sheet. One of these, particularly important in Western Australia, is the increase in the value of our mineral and energy resources. In 1989, these assets accounted for just 3% of our net wealth. Today, the figure is 12%. That's a very large change. This rise reflects both the discovery of new resources and the higher commodity prices. The higher prices have increased the present discounted value of future production, and they've meant that a higher share of the existing known reserves can be extracted economically, and so the economic value of these assets has increased. One aspect of the balance sheet that's shown relatively little change is the value of non-dwelling construction assets relative to GDP. The relative valuation of these assets did decline in the 1990s, but this trend reversed in the 2000s with the investment boom in the resources sector. In contrast, the value of machinery and equipment relative to GDP has fallen steadily since at least the late 1980s, although it's partly explained by the decline in the relative price of machinery and equipment. If we move from the past to the future, it's obviously important that we continue to invest in our asset base. While growth in the overall capital stock has been strong in recent years because of developments in the resources sector, growth in the non-mining capital stock has been quite weak. This weak growth is partly cyclical, although as the Reserve Bank has said a number of times over the past year or so, this weak cyclical investment is proving to be much more protracted than we had earlier expected. There are probably also structural elements at work, and it's possible over time that we return to this earlier downward trend in the value of our physical capital stock relative to GDP. I think one of the factors that's at work here is that a number of the strongly growing services part of the economy are not particularly capital intensive. In physical capital, they're intensive in human capital. And given this, our focus needs to be not just on creating an environment that's conducive to the accumulation of physical assets, but perhaps even more importantly over the medium term in the accumulation of human capital. Now, one other aspect of the current debates about capital spending that I'm sure Shan would have found very interesting is that surrounding infrastructure investment. His writings drew attention to the important role that such investment can play in a growing economy, but they also emphasised the importance of making sure that investments in infrastructure generate an appropriate rate of return. In his short book about the 1890s and the 1920s, Shan writes, and again I quote, Public works are excellent things, but only as long as the balance is preserved between capital and earning power. In this context, he writes rather approvingly of the appointment by Sir Henry Parkes in 1888 of Edward Eadie as the Chief Commissioner of Railways in New South Wales, stating, and again I quote, "Eadie raised the return on capital invested in the New South Wales railways from 2.85% to 3.58%, and in tramways from 1.98% to 5.28%. And he contrasts this with the outcomes in Victoria, where he writes with strong disapproval that the Victorian Railways Commissioner, one Richard Spite, and here again I quote, "caught the feverish spirit of speculation." And I think Shan's observations in this area transcend time. If we fast forward to 2015, I think there is a reasonable case that there are a number of investment projects in infrastructure that would satisfy Shan's test that the balance is preserved between capital and earning power. And this is especially so when funding costs today are lower than they were at the time that Shan was writing, and indeed, in many cases, the lowest since Federation. But as he often pointed out, money spent on infrastructure can be wasted very easily, and we've all seen examples of that. I think the key is to ensure that the right projects are selected, the construction costs are well contained, and that the risk sharing between the public and private sectors serves the public interest. Getting what I think of as governance issues right is not straightforward, but it's not impossible either. And my own view is that if we could make progress on these governance issues, that would help us build the infrastructure assets that would strengthen our national balance sheet and lift our productive capacity over time. The final aspect of this balance sheet I want to draw your attention to before returning to the issue of land prices is the gradual, although relatively small, increase in the value of our dwellings. It's excluding the land component relative to our incomes. And there are a number of factors that have contributed to this increase. One is that since the late 1980s, the average number of people living in each dwelling in Australia has fallen a little, so that the number of dwellings has increased a bit more quickly than the population. Another is that over time, the average quality of dwellings has improved and the average size of the dwellings has increased. As you can see from this chart, since the late 1980s, the average floor space of newly constructed houses has risen by almost 50%. Interestingly, though, both of these trends, that is towards smaller households but bigger dwellings, seems to have reversed in the last few years. I think these data on the value of the physical dwellings put some perspective on the claims that are sometimes made that Australians are investing too much in housing. In a sense, an upward drift in the value of the constructed housing stock relative to people's incomes is neither surprising nor remarkable. Right around the world, as people's incomes rise, they tend to use the extra income to purchase often bigger and better dwellings. Instead, what is more remarkable is that the extra resources that Australian households have used to purchase from one another the land on which these bigger and better dwellings sit. Indeed, most of the extra money that's gone into residential property has gone not into the physical stock of housing, but rather into land. So our fascination with housing is really ultimately a fascination with land. And given this, I'd now like to explore why we've seen this increase in the value of land and its implications in a bit more detail. Because taken literally, the figures that are in this graph and that I've presented invite the conclusion that our national wealth has risen largely because of higher land prices. But is such a conclusion really warranted? Have we really become wealthier as a nation simply because the value of our land has increased? Now, the answer would clearly be yes, if the increase in the value of land was because we'd discovered more of it. To my knowledge, that hasn't happened. It would also be yes if the main factor driving the increase in land prices was a large leap in the productivity of our agricultural land. And over time, crop yields have indeed increased substantially, but the resulting higher value of rural land accounts for only 5% of the increase in the total value of land in Australia since the late 1980s. Instead, as you can see in this chart, almost all the increase has come from the higher value of land upon which our dwellings are built in the towns and cities across Australia. So how do we explain this increase in the value of our residential land? There are two main structural factors that I want to draw your attention to. The first of these is the combination of financial liberalisation and low inflation. In the 70s and 80s, regulation of the financial system and high inflation effectively served to hold down land prices. They did this by limiting the amount that people could borrow. And when the financial system was liberalised and low inflation returned, people's borrowing capacity increased. And many Australians took advantage of that increased capacity and they borrowed a bit more to try and buy a slightly better property in a slightly better location. But of course, collectively, we can't all move to better properties in better locations. And so the main effect of this increased borrowing capacity was to push up the price of housing, and that really means the price of land. The second factor is a combination of strong population growth and the structural difficulties of increasing the supply of residential land. Since 1989, not that long ago, the Australian population has increased by more than 40%. It's around 7 million people. It's the fastest rate of increase amongst the advanced economies. Now, the difficulties of responding to this on the supply side of the housing market have been very well documented. They include the challenges of developing land on the urban fringe and the rezoning of land close to city centres for urban infill. They also include, in some cases, underinvestment in transportation infrastructure, both public and private. I think this underinvestment has effectively constrained the growth of the supply in well-located land at a time when the demand for this type of land has grown very strongly. And when supply is constrained and demand is strong, prices go up, and that's what's happened. Another possible structural explanation is that the higher land prices reflect an upward revision to people's expectations about future income growth, and thus the amount they're prepared to pay for the land. Now, one possible reason this could be occurring is that the growth of our cities generates positive externalities. By bringing more people together, competition is increased and perhaps productivity is lifted. And this might be part of the story, but I don't really think it's a central part of the story. Real income growth per capita did pick up markedly from around the mid-1990s, but it subsequently slowed very substantially, and that's had apparently little effect on the price of land relative to our incomes. So the story is really one of increased borrowing capacity, extraordinarily strong population growth, and a slow supply response. Now, you might ask why it matters what the reason is that land prices have gone up. After all, regardless of the reason, if you own land, you've received a large capital gain, and it's, the rise in land prices has made many Australians better off. I think the complication here, though, comes from the fact that Australians are both owners of housing assets and consumers of housing services. We just don't own housing and land on which that housing is built, but we live in that housing and we live on that land. And that housing and the land provides us with a flow of apparently very valuable services. And if housing is fairly valued in the sense that the price of the housing is equal to the present discounted value of future rents, then the rise in prices implies an increase in the expected future cost of housing services. So from the perspective of society as a whole, much of what is gained on the one hand is lost on the other. There are windfall gains from higher land prices, but then everyone pays more for housing services. How anyone individual is affected by all of that depends upon their own circumstances. If an older person who owns their own house and has no children, they receive a capital gain from the higher land prices that must surely offset the expected future higher future housing costs. So such a household is surely better off. The same is true for owners of investment properties, since they own multiple properties on which they earn the capital gain. But in contrast, for a young homeowner with multiple children, the calculation can look very different indeed. If they care about the future housing costs of their children, then at least in some circumstances, it's possible that the higher future expected housing costs could exceed the capital gain that they earn on their dwellings. In a welfare sense, for these households, the increase in land prices could actually make them worse off, even though they own their own property. The same is obviously true for renters, as they don't have any capital gain at all to offset the higher future housing costs. Now, you might think that only an economist would argue in these terms to worry that a capital gain on an asset that you actually own could make you worse off because of some vague notion of future of higher future housing costs, especially for your children. And you might be right. But I think many Australians have an innate understanding of the concept, and they share the concern. Many parents around the country look at the high housing prices, again, really high land prices, and worry that their children will not be able to afford the type of property that they themselves have been able to live in, even if their children were to have the same lifestyle income profile that they themselves had had. In effect, these parents are doing the present discounted value calculation, and they don't like what they see. So it's arguable that the main impact of higher land prices is not really to increase our national wealth, but to change the distribution of that wealth. And there are two elements to this change in distribution. One is cross-sectional, with the existing owners of dwellings receiving capital gains when land prices increase. The second is the distribution of wealth across generations, with current owners of dwellings earning capital gains, but future generations paying higher housing costs. Both of these aspects of changing wealth distribution have economic and social consequences, and I don't think we fully understand either of them. How the intergenerational distribution ultimately plays out depends critically upon the extent to which the gains that have accrued to the current owners of property are passed on to the next generation. Unfortunately, we know relatively little about intergenerational transfers in Australia, but what we do know suggests that things may be gradually changing. And one illustration of this is in the Hilda survey, which suggests that over time, there has been a slight increase in the share of first homeowners that are receiving loans from family and friends. There's also some evidence that younger generations are receiving increased assistance with household expenses from older generations, including by continuing to live in the family home for a longer period of time. In my view, it's quite likely that these trends will continue, with it becoming more commonplace for parents to help their children in the property market. And this has, I think, both important economic and social consequences. Of course, if this type of intergenerational assistance does become more common, then fewer parents will be able to use the capital gains that they've benefited from to boost their own spending. Instead, in effect, they'll be using those capital gains to support the following generations with their higher housing costs. Alternatively, it turns out that today's generations use these capital gains to increase their own spending, then they'll have less ability to help their children. If this were to happen, then I suspect over time there would be some downward pressure on the price of housing relative to incomes as the future generations deal with these higher costs of housing services. In my remaining time, I really want to touch on three issues that are relevant to monetary policy that are closely related to the topics that I've just been talking about. The first is the link between higher housing prices and household spending. There's a well-established research literature that empirically demonstrates that higher housing wealth boosts household consumption. Indeed, colleagues of mine at the Reserve Bank have estimated that a rise in wealth of $100 leads to non-housing spending increasing by between $2 and $4 a year. So then there are two commonly accepted mechanisms through which this relationship occurs. The first is a pure wealth effect. To the extent that higher dwelling prices increase incomes, a household should spend a little of that extra... to the extent that higher dwelling prices increase wealth, households should spend a little of the extra wealth each year over their lifetime. The second is what is known as the collateral channel. As higher land prices increase the value of collateral that can be posted for potential borrowers, and the increased collateral makes it easy for credit-constrained households to borrow to increase their spending, and it also makes it easier for businesses to finance projects. So there are these two channels, both have been seen historically to be important. But over recent years, there's been some reinterpretation of these channels, particularly the pure wealth effect. In part, this reflects the issues that I've just been speaking about a few moments ago. That is, higher housing prices not only deliver capital gains for existing owners, but they imply higher housing higher prices for future housing services. The reinterpretation of the evidence is that the link between housing wealth and spending arises not so much through this traditional wealth channel, but rather because higher housing prices are sometimes a proxy for faster expected income growth in the future. And it's this lift in expected income growth that spending's really responding to. Interestingly, other colleagues of mine at the RBA have been examining this idea recently, again using data from the Hilda survey. And they find a clear evidence in favour of a collateral channel, especially for younger households, which is what you would expect. But they find no evidence at all in favour of the traditional pure wealth effect. Instead, their evidence is consistent with this alternative expected income idea. And perhaps the most intriguing aspect of their results is that when housing prices in a particular area, let's say a suburb, increase, renters in that area, that suburb, increase their consumption. So when housing prices in an area increase, renters increase their consumption, as well as owner-occupiers. And the conclusion that my colleagues reach, and I think it's valid, is that often it's a common third factor, such as higher expected future income, or at least less income uncertainty, that's at least partly responsible for the observed association between housing wealth and spending. If this conclusion's correct, then I think it does help partly explain what's going on in the economy right at the moment. In the early 2000s, when housing prices and real incomes were rising very quickly, many households used the higher value of their housing assets to increase their spending. But nowadays, that's not happening to anything like the same extent. With slower expected income growth and increased concerns about future housing costs, particularly for the children, the response to higher housing prices currently looks to be smaller than it was previously, and this smaller response is affecting overall spending in the economy. The second issue I want to touch on is the increase in debt that's accompanied the higher land prices. Throughout the talk, I've barely touched the liability side, And that's for the reasons I spoke about at the start. Financing transactions that are internal to the country do not change our net wealth. These financing transactions do, though, have a material impact on the profile and on the riskiness of the individual balance sheets within the economy. This rise in land prices that I've spoken about is inextricably linked to the rise in household borrowing, as I spoke about before. Together, these two developments have grossed up the household sector's balance sheet, and you can see this in this chart. And this means that on the asset side of the balance sheet, a given percentage change in housing prices has a bigger effect than it once did, and on the liability side, movements in interest rates have a bigger effect than they once did. We're still trying to fully understand the implications of all of this. However, I think it's difficult to escape the conclusion that household balance sheets are, on average, a little more risky than they once were. And many Australian households seem to have reached a similar conclusion. I think this is reflected in a decision by many of them over recent years to take a more prudent approach to their spending. Indeed, I suspect that it's unlikely to be in our national interest for this more prudent approach to give way to household consumption once again growing consistently much faster than our incomes. And this is something that we continue to be cognizant of in the setting of monetary policy. Some decline in the rate of household savings probably appropriate as the economy rebalances after the terms of trade and mining investment booms. But given the position of household balance sheets, it's unlikely to be in our long-term interests for consumption to again a consumption boom to begin financed by a pickup in household sector borrowing. And that brings me to my final issue, and that's the need to generate sustainable growth in the economy. Monetary policy can play some role here, including by helping reduce uncertainty, by maintaining low and stable inflation, and some overall stability in the economy. But monetary policy is ultimately not a driver of medium-term growth. Indeed, while low interest rates are currently helping the economy through a period of transition, an extended period of low interest rates implies ongoing low returns to savers and low underlying returns on assets. And this is not a world that we should be aspiring to. So one of the challenges that we face as a country is to lift the expected risk-adjusted return on investment in new assets, whether they're physical assets or whether they're human capital. I think if we can do this, when we'll see the investment in new assets that is crucial to the sustainable expansion in the economy. There's no single lever that can be pulled here, but neither is there a shortage of sensible ideas that, if implemented, could improve the environment for the creation of new assets in our country. I think these ideas would include a strengthening of the culture of innovation, the removal of unnecessary and overly complicated regulation, and making competition work effectively in the whole range of markets across our country. I think increased investment in infrastructure, including in transport, probably also has a role to play here. Done properly, it can help lift the return to other forms of investment in a wide range of industries across the country. Better transportation can also increase the effective supply of well-located land, making housing more affordable for many Australians. Again, none of this is easy, but neither is it impossible. I want to now conclude by, with three brief closing observations. The first is that rising land and housing prices have made many, but not all, Australians better off. They've also changed the distribution of wealth within our society and between generations, and we're still coming to grips with the implications of this. Ever-rising housing prices relative to our incomes do increase risks in the economy, and they are unlikely to make us better off as a nation. Rising housing prices are best matched by rising incomes. The second observation is that real wealth generation for the society as a whole comes from asset accumulation and lifting productivity. While the rise in the value of our resource base over the past decade has improved our national balance sheet substantially, we can't rely on that occurring again. So further improvement in the national balance sheet requires us to invest in both physical and human capital, and it requires us to come up with new ideas and better ways of doing things. And the third and related observation is that balance sheets have two sides. They have a liability side and they have an asset side, and both sides need to be managed carefully. We need to make sure that our liabilities are sustainable and that they're managed prudently. Nick Shan's writings remind us of what can happen if we don't do that. But we also need to make sure that we continue to invest in the assets that form the basis of sustainable growth in our national incomes over the years ahead. So thank you very much. You've been very patient. Thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
My name is Vic Power. I'm a professional engineer, and I've been involved in entrepreneurial development and major projects for some time. The major part of my superannuation investment, I took on board small and mid-cap stocks because of the potential in them. The investigations I put into selecting those stocks were very clear. They were not speculative. And yet what I have found is that when we get into that realm, those stocks are the subject of attack from hedge funds and margin lenders, and to the point of any incentive for the wealth in those stocks is taken away. Have the RBA or others looked at the possibility of seeing how something can be introduced, or whether I'm on the right track in my assessment, which has probably gone on for more than 10, 15 years now, whether I'm right in the fact these small companies, if they succeed, are the key to wealth. They become big companies like West Farmers and the big BHPs and so forth. So it's quite essential that the incentives be maintained to invest in those companies. Thank you.
Well, I'm not in a position to address your specific question. I think if there are things that are going on there that concern you, they should be raised with ASIC. It's not there of the Reserve Bank's responsibility. But I think you do touch on a kind of an important point, and that is that the role that small and medium-sized businesses play in the economy. They are typically the part of the economy where the innovation occurs, the driver of new ideas. They're the businesses that come in and compete with the existing well-established businesses with new ideas and new ways of doing things. So making sure that health sector of the economy is very healthy is important, and this is this culture of innovation. How do we build the culture of innovation? I think it does partly start with small and medium-sized businesses, but the specific issue you raise about trading in those stocks, I'm not in a position to answer that.
Dr. Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. I just wanted to ask you about China's devaluation of its currency in the past 2 days, which has seen the yuan fall by the most since 1994. It sparked a significant amount of turmoil in markets and speculation that China might have taken this action in response to an increasingly faltering economy. What are the implications of a weaker yuan for Australia, and how concerned are you about the trajectory of China's economy? Thank you.
Thank you. I think there are multiple interpretations about what's going on here at the moment. One is that the Chinese currency, having moved up against the US dollar, moved in parallel with the US dollar over the last year or so, has moved up quite a lot against other currencies. And so on an effective basis, it had a substantial appreciation. And what we're really seeing is some unwinding of that. So that's one interpretation. Another is that the growth momentum in China is a bit weaker than the authorities had expected, and the exchange rate adjustment is part of the correction for that, as has been the lowering of interest rates and increased spending on infrastructure. And the third possible interpretation is that they're actually taking steps to move to a more market-based exchange rate. They've been saying for years that that was their intention. Many international observers have been encouraging them in that direction. And I think it's quite probable that this is actually a step to a more flexible Chinese currency. All three interpretations are probably have some element of truth to it, but this is a very recent development, so I think it's too early to tell which of those is, or perhaps they're all correct. The implications for us, and again, it's very early, so I think it's hard to tell. It partly depends upon what's driving this change. If it supports growth in our largest trading partner, it's probably good. More fundamentally, if it reflects a commitment by the Chinese authorities to move to a more market-based system, a more market-based exchange rate system, then I think that's good for China over the medium term. So if it's a positive sign about structural reform, a stronger commitment to markets, then that's ultimately good for China. And if it's good for China, then it's probably good for us. So while it's led to some movements in currencies and stock markets and interest rate markets around the world, it's possible that it's actually in the longer term exactly what's needed. I think it's too early to tell. We know that movements in exchange rates often offer a chain reaction of events which can be difficult to predict. So I think we've all got to watch what's going on very carefully, but particularly in Asia, because many currencies have adjusted in the last couple of days. So we're watching that carefully, but If it does reflect a genuine commitment to reform, then I think ultimately this is good news.
I'm Rod Tyers from here in the Business School in the Economics discipline. I'd like to draw a link between the last question and your talk, perhaps start by making a brief comment on the last question, which is that the underlying real exchange rate, if you do it on producer prices for China, in the last 4 years or so has been declining fairly continuously. So they've had deflation on producer prices, which suggests that their monetary policy in maintaining a fixed exchange rate against the US, a pseudo-fixed exchange rate against the US, has been too tight, and that this is merely a possibly positive, as you suggest, monetary expansion. Now, to try to link the two stories, I mean, the critical thing that emerges from your talk to me is this rise, which in your graphs is a very sudden rise over a period of 3 or 4 years or so in Australian land prices. And that rise tends to coincide very closely with the most rapid surge in Chinese growth, which makes me think that there is a broader story than just the Australian market to tell here. That is that Australia is small. We're in a corner of the world which has expanded extremely rapidly since about 2002. And that has meant all land in safe and well-supported cities in our region has become more valuable simply because Asian demand for that land has risen. And so that this represents an alternative story to the one that says we've borrowed too much and we've competed with one another to have larger houses. Moreover, relating to the last question, there are signs of slowing and weakening of the Chinese economy. At the same time, China's outward capital controls have been weakened in recent years, and that means very wealthy people are able to move their money out more easily. And this, I suspect, may be accelerating this demand for Australian housing.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to disagree with you on one thing and then strongly support you on another. The rise in housing, the really big rise in housing prices in Australia relative to our incomes took place between 1996 and 2003. That was before the resources boom. Through much of that period, Australia was an old-fashioned economy. People were saying we needed to produce computer chips. You know, we were doomed. The terms of trade were in decline. So the predominant reason for this rise in housing prices, I don't think, can be kind of the growth of China, because a large part of the story predates that. But I do want to agree with you kind of on the second part of your observation. There's really the potential for capital outflows out of China to have profound effect on asset markets everywhere. Because over recent years, the central bank has accumulated a very large stock of foreign currency reserves. It was up to around $4 trillion. So effectively, it has taken Chinese savings and invested them in the rest of the world. As the Chinese capital account liberalises, the central bank is no longer going to be doing that. The private Chinese citizens and entities within China, other than the central bank, are going to be taking Chinese savings and investing them around the world. And Chinese citizens are going to want to hold internationally diversified portfolios, just like everyone in this room effectively does through their superannuation funds. So there's going to be quite a large change in the type of assets that Chinese entities want to hold relative to what the central bank held. The volatility of those flows is going to be different. And I don't, it's one of these, I think, really big issues that we yet don't fully understand. And it may well turn out to be one of the biggest issues in global finance in the next decade, the liberalisation of the Chinese capital account and the ramifications that come with that.
I'm Paul Johnson. I'm an economic historian and also the Vice Chancellor of UWA. In the 1980s, rising land and rising housing prices made many, but not all, Japanese people better off and changed the distribution of wealth in Japan and changed the intergenerational distribution. And that's been followed by two decades of stagnation. What are the grounds for believing Australia won't follow a similar pattern?
I think that the major one, and this is a huge difference, is population. The Japanese population is already in decline, and from my recollection, in the official projections are in the next 25 years, the Japanese population will fall between 15 and 20%. It's staggering. In Australia, population has been growing, last year 1.5, and over the last decade, close to an average of 2. It's a very, very different dynamic. And when the population's rising strongly, it's hard to see how land prices actually come down relative to incomes, because the demand for well-located land is increasing every day. The supply of that land is not increasing every day. So in contrast that with Japan, there are fewer and fewer people living on the land every year. I think that's the main difference. You could point to things about the underlying dynamism of the economy, but the population or demographics, something we don't really talk very much about, it's profound in this area.
My name's Ian Warner. I'm just a simple lawyer and company director, not an economist. But I was very interested in your comments in land values, the way they have increased. And I'm also reminded that David Airy, who's the president of the Real Estate Institute, he's constantly said in recent times that the average value of an American home is about $250,000. Whereas the average value of an Australian home is $500,000. And to my non-economic mind, it's hard to grasp the fact that that an economy like America, which is so very much more diverse and stronger than Australia, has a housing average of $250,000. So I'd be very interested in your comments on that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting observation. Of course, America, at least the United States on average, has one of the lowest housing prices relative to incomes ratios in the world. And ours is in the range of it's in the high-ish range, but in a range that a number of other countries are in. I think the fundamental reason is that we as a society have chosen to live on blocks of land, detached housing in large cities on the coast. And you look around the world, where do you find the highest house prices. They're in kind of large coastal cities with a lot of amenity. So that's where we've chosen to live. And we also want to consume a lot of land. Each house in Australia has a lot of land, and they're located in these cities. And we've chosen simultaneously not to invest that much, at least in many states, in infrastructure. So the ability to move around our cities is compromised by underinvestment in infrastructure. Yet we've chosen to live in these cities with large tracts of land. And that's why we have high land prices. In the United States, while the population's much bigger, it's much more dispersed. There are many, many more medium-sized cities. Typically, the zoning restrictions aren't as strong, and there's better transport, at least there's better road transportation. I think that's at the heart of it. It's where we choose to live as a society and the underinvestment in transport.
Thanks for the talk, Dr. Lowe. My name's Ian. I'm a journalism graduate, and I'm studying economics at Murdoch University. I wanted to ask, you showed that IP makes up a smaller percentage of asset wealth in numerous other categories. How do we compare to other developed nations in this regard? Why do we get this specific outcome, and is it a concern? Do we simply not have the capability of commercializing knowledge we create to the same extent as competitor nations, or are we not creating knowledge? Is it simply our knowledge is in small to medium businesses and is being bought up and taken overseas, or being exploited without being built upon? And what should we do about this, if anything, as we are often told we need to be the knowledge economy?
Yeah. Thank you. It's a very good question. Unfortunately, the comparable data across countries here is quite limited. From having looked at the material that's available, my conclusion is we're not that much different to most other developed economies in terms of the value of our stock of intellectual capital relative to our incomes. The question is, how do we really create the environment where there's greater investment in intellectual capital, ideas and business processes and research and development? And that's a kind of great question. I'm not going to give you a great answer, though. The things that I've read where Australia stands out on the negative side are really, and this is maybe I shouldn't be saying this in this building, but the relationship between business and universities. That somehow in Australia we haven't managed to create that dynamic environment and positive feedback loop between business and university. That we're quite good at doing kind of base research, but we're not as good at commercialising that. And the fact that we're not as good at commercialising then feeds back in the incentives to do it in the first place. So I'm way beyond my area of expertise here, but this is kind of, I'm just reflecting on the international studies that have been done here. The kind of other related issues, really, when I touched on before, is really the kind of the culture of innovation. How as a society do we increase the incentives or our capability to innovate and to come up with new ideas? Because in a speech I gave last year, I reflected on the increase in risk aversion in our society, that in many respects we've become more risk averse as a nation, which is in a sense ironic because we're really a nation of migrants. You know, 40% of, I think, Australians either were born overseas or have a parent who was born overseas. So these are people who've come to Australia kind of prepared to take a risk with their parents. So we should be a nation of great entrepreneurs, and yet our culture is becoming more risk-averse. So you know, how do we as a society, a government, business, universities, become less risk-averse and be prepared to invest in risky ideas that can ultimately pay off? So I know that's not a very specific answer to your question, but I think you're pointing at a really important thing, and you know others in the room are probably better placed to answer it than I am.
We're getting near the end. Okay, 1, 2, 3, and then we have time. Thank you.
Rebecca White, public servant and postgraduate in economics at UWA. You've talked a lot about investment in infrastructure. In recent years, we've seen a lot of the investment in the resources sector infrastructure come from the private sector, so example, ports and rail and even roads. Going forward, what proportion of that investment do you think needs to come from the public sector, and what should fall back on the private sector?
Thanks, Rebecca. I think it's hard to divide it between the public and private sector because the private sector can do road toll roads, they can build railways. So it's not really, I don't see it as a public-private split in terms of kind of the financing of it. The issue is, I think the main issue is really which projects do you do? There are plenty of projects that could be done around the country, and it's really the governance of selecting the projects. How do we get that right? Because there's plenty of money to finance infrastructure. In my job, I speak to a lot of investors, and a lot of them, particularly international ones, say they want infrastructure assets, they want Australian infrastructure assets, but there's just not the generation of these assets coming through for them to purchase. So what is it that, and this is really a rhetorical question, what is it that can be done to kind of bring that pipeline of infrastructure projects, which there is clearly financing for, and will clearly make our society better off? How do we organise ourselves to actually do that? And I think it's, in my own view, there's a lot to be said for governance here, because in a sense, broadly speaking, the public don't trust the political class about which projects are selected, and so they don't like spending public money. And this is something that Ed Shan talked a lot about. How do you bring that? How do you give the public, us, confidence that if the public sector are going to do it, they're going to choose the right projects? So again, sorry, it's not very specific to your answer to your question, but I think it's a really good issue.
So I'm Peter Hartley, I'm a professor in the economics department here at the UWA, but also I'm a professor at Rice University in Houston in Texas, economics. It's going to become relevant in a moment.
Yeah.
I want to make two observations. The first one is you had a graph of the different categories of land, and one thing that showed is that it's mainly been urban land values that have gone up and rural land values have not, which implies the ratio of urban land values to rural land values has gone up. And given you can convert land from rural use to urban use, that suggests that restrictions on that conversion capability are really important in driving the increase in urban land values. So we've had more restrictions on, zoning restrictions on that have stopped that. I want to relate that to the comments about the United States and very low house prices there. One thing you'll notice, of course, if you look at some of the states where there have been lots more zoning restrictions, California, Oregon, Florida, there's some and so on, compare that with, let's say, Texas, where it's very, very easy to convert land from agricultural use to urban use. You'll find that the very, really low house prices, places like Houston and Dallas, you know, maybe also Atlanta and so on, some of these other cities where it's also possible. Whereas some of these cities where it's really there are lots and lots of zoning restrictions, it's very hard to convert the land where you had the big house price or land price increases, as you say. So it seems to me a lot of this increase in the ratio of urban price to rural price is driven by policies restricting the growth of cities. That, of course, advantages, like you said, homeowners, but it disadvantages the young people who are wanting to get into the business. So these policies have significant effects, apart from sort of people who are opposed to urban sprawl and so on and want to stop development. Anyway, that couple of observations. Yep. I wanted to make to get your comments on it.
Yeah.
Follows from some of the data you've got, plus the observations about the United States.
Yeah. In preparation for this talk, one of my colleagues who was assisting me, I asked him whether he could find out, kind of back when Shan was writing, what the value of the land value in Australia, or how much of it was rural. And I can't remember the name of the person who'd done the study. It's footnoted in my remarks. But their estimate was, I think in 1930, 30%, maybe a bit more than that, of the value of the land in Australia was rural land. Today the figure's in kind of single digits. So it's all in the cities. The observation that zoning is incredibly important, it's hard to disagree. I mean, you can't disagree with that. Economics is about supply and demand. If you restrict the supply and the demand is going up, price goes up. It's not much more complicated than that. Of course, if you just allow free zoning and don't put transportation in, then still the land close to the city can go up in price. So I think it's a combination of zoning and transport. In the city, American cities that have quite low housing prices, you're right, they don't have very many zoning restrictions, and they've probably built freeways out there so people can live 35 kilometres from the centre of the city and still get around, at least at some times of the day. So I think it's this combination of zoning and transport investment.
We'll go to the last two questions.
Yeah, Craig Carter. I'm a member of the GMA, which is the alumni group for MBA graduates from this university. You talk about assets producing a return, and you also mentioned Shan was looking at the returns of some of the public transport from years ago, the rail transport.
Yeah.
I find it's difficult to reconcile sort of expenditure on the public transport on the one hand, where it's supposed to make some economic return. On the other balance sheet is, of course, the expenditure on the roads, which I'm not sure how they actually work out the return on roads, because apart from private roads, which might have then a toll, the public road system is basically provided for free use. Are we getting the balance right in Australia in terms of those? Because obviously there's implications. Public transport avoids the costs of buying as many fully imported cars as we're moving towards now, and imported fuel. And of course the cars are, they have their own deficiencies in terms of time getting to the destination and things like that. So how do you reconcile those two expenditures? Because I think the moment the federal government is certainly biased towards funding of this in their sphere, the road system.
Yeah. Well, both public and private transport obviously have a kind of important role to play in increasing the supply of well-located land. Whether we're doing too much of one or not enough of the other, I don't want to comment on. But there are, the quote that I recited in my talk about the return on railway investment in New South Wales and in Victoria, there are ways that you can capture. In the 1920s, people were talking about the rate of return on this. So there are ways that you can capture both through the fares and something that we really haven't talked very much in Australia about is kind of capturing for the by the state of the uplift in values. You're seeing this is in Singapore and Hong Kong, they partly finance the investment in public infrastructure, the government owning the land. You put a subway system there, the land's all of a sudden more valuable and you sell it off. So the entity that's financing the investment actually captures some of the capital gains. And I was just reading in the paper yesterday in Sydney how landowners are getting together in large groups around the new railway stations and selling their property and capturing the value of the land privately. And I'm not saying that there's anything particularly wrong with that, but there are ways that you can measure and in some cases capture the value of the benefits from these investments to help finance them. Whether we're doing that optimally or not, you can probably draw your own conclusion.
Anyway, this brings us to the last question.
Dr. Lowe, earlier on when you responded to one of my colleagues' questions, you commented that the biggest rise in house prices was over between 1992 to 2002. And it had me thinking about wages policy, because that period, as you'd be aware, coincided with the mathematical shift in how the street was set wages at the end of the Accord in 1992 was the start of enterprise bargaining path to decentralised wage fixing. And since then, of course, we've seen a shift in income inequality, and individuals now recognise that income inequality is an important and problematic social and economic issue for Australia and its challenges. And so my question is, what levers does the Reserve Bank have to address this? And more specifically, do you see a role for wages policy? We recently saw the Productivity Commission come out and recommend that we actually reduce penalty rates in the low-paid sectors, which clearly has got the potential to further contribute to inequality and certainly not violence. So I would really value your comments.
Well, I think my very narrow answer is the Reserve Bank has no role here at all in wages policy. We have the modest task of setting the overnight interest rates that banks lend to one another at. That's our. I think if you look at the Australian labour market over the past decade, I think it's performed pretty well. I mean, we had, I don't need to say this in Perth, we had the biggest terms of trade shock in 150 years, the biggest mining investment boom in at least 100 years, and we didn't have a generalised outbreak of inflation across. We had certain pockets where there was very strong demand for labour and wages went up, but across the economy that did not happen, and it happened every other time we'd had a mining boom. And now as we're coming on to the downside of the mining investment boom, wage growth has slowed a lot. And that's, it's not very comfortable, but it's helping the adjustment. And I think it's one of the reasons why employment growth has been surprisingly strong in recent times, that the slower wage growth has kept more people in jobs than would have been the case. So the labour market is turning out to be remarkably flexible. That's not to say that there aren't kind of things that we should be looking at all the time to make sure that it continues to service the needs of the economy. But from where I sit as a macroeconomist, and I don't have the same perspective as you, but from a macroeconomist, the labour market has performed remarkably well, and together with the exchange rate and interest rates, the flexibility in those key three key variables has got us through at the type of external economic shock that in previous generations would have caused all sorts of economic dislocation, and that hasn't happened on this occasion. Not to say that there aren't things we should continue to look at, though.
Well, thank you very much, Philip. I think all of us are privileged here to hear your very wide-ranging presentation on issues which cover intergenerational equity and welfare and wealth in this broad way, which perhaps not all of us have appreciated featuring central bank thinking. So that was a fascinating presentation. So on behalf of everyone in here, on behalf of the Economic Society as well as the Adelaide Business School, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.